From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, two enormous explosions rock the Iranian embassy in Beirut, killing more than 20. We'll get the latest and examine the background to today's blasts. Also, the value of Bitcoin soars as Congress considers whether the virtual currency should be regulated.
Virtual currencies have captured the imagination of some and confused the heck out of the rest of us.
From London, the revival of craft gin distilleries driven by global demand, and the return of Monty Python's Flying Circus.
I wish to complain about this parrot what I purchased not half an hour ago from this very boutique. It's dead, that's what's wrong with it.
But will the dead parrot sketch appeal to today's audiences? That's coming up on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. 23 people have been killed and at least 140 injured after a double suicide bombing outside Iran's embassy in Beirut. Lebanese officials say a militant group with al-Qaeda links has claimed responsibility for the bloodshed. At a UN Security Council meeting Tuesday, the UN's top political official Jeffrey Feltman said the attack was appalling.
This appalling attack was widely condemned by Lebanese politicians across the political spectrum. The Secretary General has issued a statement condemning this terrorist attack and extends his condolences to the families of those killed and to the government of Lebanon and to the Islamic Republic of Iran.
A secret court order authorizing America's National Security Agency to gather emails and internet data has been made public by the U.S. government. A document detailing a judge's concerns about systematic violations of that order have also been released. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
The court ordered that intelligence agents could only access stored data under very specific circumstances related to individuals who were connected to a terrorism suspect and authorized two specific search methods. The released documents include a memo sent to the House and Senate Intelligence Committees in 2009, which show the NSA admitted consistent violations of those rules and that the court expressed grave concern over the matter. Daniel Wrenches, Washington.
A Russian court has granted bail to a group of foreign Greenpeace activists, the first activist to be released after nearly 2 months in jail. The court set bail at $61,500 or 2 million rubles for each of the 10 activists to be paid within the next 4 days. Anya Ardaeva reports from Moscow.
Greenpeace protesters from Argentina, Brazil, Canada, Italy, New Zealand and Poland will be released from jail once the environmental group pays a total of over $600,000 in bail within the next 4 days. Upon their release, the activists will be awaiting trial on charges of hooliganism. No trial date has yet been set. 30 people aboard a Greenpeace ship were detained in September following a protest outside a floating oil rig belonging to the Russian energy monopoly Gazprom. They were initially charged with piracy, but investigators later said they were bringing hooliganism charges instead. People convicted of hooliganism in Russia are normally subject to fines. 19 other activists are expecting court rulings on their detentions in the next few days. Anya Ardaeva, Moscow.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. More than half of Americans now disapprove of President Obama's performance, according to a new poll published by The Washington Post and ABC News. The number represents the worst rating of his presidency, with the same survey showing opposition to the Affordable Care Act hitting a record high. Our Washington correspondent Lorna Shattuck has the details.
It seems the flaws in rolling out the Affordable Care Act have pushed President Obama's approval ratings ever lower. 57% of Americans told a Washington Post and ABC News poll that they oppose the new law, Mr. Obama's signature domestic initiative. His personal disapproval rating now stands at 55%. Just a month ago, before the glitches in the scheme's website became apparent, the public was more evenly divided in its opinions. Disapproval of the president's handling of the healthcare law rollout now stands at 63%, 10 points more than last month. The polling is the first to be released since Mr. Obama's press conference last week, in which he acknowledged his mistakes and announced a fix to the legislation, allowing Americans to keep insurance policies that were being cancelled by the Affordable Care Act. Lorna Shattuck, Washington.
And the embattled mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford, has said he's given up alcohol after he was stripped of his power by the city council. The elected official is refusing to step down amidst a scandal in which he admitted smoking crack cocaine. Nick Harper reports.
In the latest installment in the Rob Ford saga, being interviewed by CBC's Peter Mansbridge, the mayor said he'd stopped drinking alcohol for good.
You're done with alcohol.
Finished.
You'll never drink again.
Finished. You know, I've had a come-to-Jesus moment, if you want to call it that. The people I've let down, and it's all because of alcohol. Excessive, stupid, immature behavior.
He also denied being a drug addict, admitting the time he took crack cocaine was an isolated incident, and saying he simply had a fun time on the weekends. On Monday, the city council voted to slash his budget, reduce his staff, and transfer many of his powers to Toronto's deputy mayor. He called the vote a coup d'etat, and reaffirmed his intention to run for re-election next year. Nick Harper, New York.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. Around 24 people were killed and scores injured today after a double suicide bombing targeted the Iranian embassy in Beirut. The casualties included Iran's cultural attaché in the Lebanese capital. Iran's ambassador blamed Israel for the attack, an accusation the Israelis quickly denied. Lebanese officials said a militant group with ties to Al-Qaeda claimed responsibility for the bloodshed. The ongoing conflict in neighbouring Syria has been blamed for inflaming ethnic tensions in Lebanon. FSN's Kevin McAleese spoke to Beirut-based journalist for Al Akbar newspaper, Mark Abizad.
So far, you know, they haven't had the security footage released, but what has been reported is that they do have security footage from the embassy that shows a suicide bomber on a motorcycle charged the embassy. He blew himself up, which opened the way for a second suicide bomber who drove a car that was packed with explosives in front of the embassy. And the second bombing, I think, was the one that caused the most casualties. About 23 people have been reported dead, according to the Ministry of Health.
Do we know anything about who is actually claiming responsibility for this attack?
There's an Al-Qaeda linked group that's claimed responsibility. Anyone can claim responsibility. It hasn't been confirmed, but this is a group that's based in Lebanon that has some connections with Fatah al-Islam, which was this group that was based in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon. But we don't have all the information of exactly who was responsible and what the credibility is of their claims.
What sort of message do you think this attack was supposed to send to Iran?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that they're pretty serious that that since Hezbollah entered Syria, that the tide of the war has been turned heavily in favor of the Syrian government, and these Salafi groups are losing battle after battle now in Syria, and so they've turned their sights on Lebanon, which is the next, the easiest target for them now.
Is this something Beirut have become accustomed to, or has this come as a shock to the people there?
No, I mean, especially the nature of this attack in particular, I think is a little bit shocking because, over the last few months there's been a series of car bombs, but I mean, this is different. This is a suicide bombing, which I don't think has ever happened before in Lebanon, targeting a civilian population. The last time I think there was a suicide bombing in Lebanon, it was targeting Israeli occupation in the south. So this is entirely of a different nature, and I think it's heightened levels of fear in the country. This is a little bit unprecedented.
Has there been any official response from the Lebanese government?
Well, of course, every party, every side, no one's going to stand with the people who created all this fear and destruction and death. So, I mean, it's just been statement after statement condemning condemning the bombings and urging citizens to remain vigilant.
Mark Abizad with the Al Akbar newspaper in Beirut. Now, just 24 hours before today's attack on the Iranian embassy in the Lebanese capital, Iran's deputy foreign minister was in Moscow for talks on a diplomatic solution to the Syrian crisis. FSN's correspondent in the Russian capital, Tom Barton, followed events.
Mr. Abdullahian kept his focus on Syria for most of the press conference and talked up hopes for long-delayed peace talks, already called Geneva II and planned this time for mid-December. When it comes to Syria's opposition, he is, unsurprisingly, much more dismissive, expressing doubts they would even be able to send a delegation.
We understand the Syrian opposition isn't fully ready to take part in the Geneva peace talks.
With the opposition to Bashar Assad's forces seen as key to negotiations by most parties, that could prove a fatal blow to the talks. On the subject of the war, Abdullahian is keen to point out what he says are his country's great efforts to try and bring the conflict to a peaceful resolution and provide humanitarian assistance there. However, he isn't so kind about what he sees as the influence of others in the nearly three-year civil war.
Regrettably, some sides are sending militants to Syria and supplying them with weapons.
That will strike many observers as rank hypocrisy, doubled by the deputy foreign minister's claim that Iran is only supplying medical and humanitarian aid. Tehran and Moscow, where the press conference was held, have been accused worldwide of illegally supplying masses of weapons, as well as diplomatic cover to Bashar Assad's forces. Russia has vetoed UN resolutions criticising Assad's crackdown, and such things as his army's use of heavy artillery and aerial bombing of built-up civilian areas. Iran has even sent its own military forces into Syria, a claim made widely across the country. Whether talks do materialise in Geneva, this latest broadside from Tehran shows only division over Syria and not the desperately needed attempts at conciliation. Tom Barton, Moscow.
This is FSN Reports. The US Congress is holding its first ever hearings on Bitcoin and other virtual currencies as they gain popularity worldwide thanks to their low transaction fees and user anonymity. Yesterday, the value of a Bitcoin unit soared to new highs simply by dint of the discussions taking place on Capitol Hill. While some businesses and lawmakers say virtual currencies can help low-income people participate in the global marketplace, federal law enforcement agencies are warning that the technology is already popular with drug traffickers, child pornographers, and other criminals. From Capitol Hill, FSN's Alice Alstein reports.
The Senate's Homeland Security and Banking Committees are questioning legal experts, federal regulators, and tech leaders about the strengths and drawbacks of online currencies like Bitcoin. Patrick Merck, the general counsel for the Bitcoin Foundation, testified Monday, saying he'd like to help the U.S. government better understand how the technology works.
There is no Bitcoin company that manages or controls the software or its operation. The software is built and maintained by a community of volunteer open source software engineers and a distributed network of transaction processing, often referred to as mining. At its most basic level, Bitcoin is an internet protocol. It's like email for money.
But several federal agents testifying at the hearing shared concerns, listing instances they've seen digital money used for criminal purposes. Multiple witnesses cited the recent federal bust of the international online market Silk Road, where drugs, forged documents, weapons, and other criminal goods and services were sold. Noting that Silk Road customers often used virtual currency, Mithali Raman from the Justice Department characterized the technology as an emerging threat, but said it's not inherently illegal.
And they can be appealing to consumers because they can provide cheap, efficient, and convenient means to transfer currency. Many of those same features, however, also make virtual currencies appealing to criminals. We have seen increasing use of such currencies by drug dealers, traffickers of child pornography, and perpetrators of large-scale fraud schemes. Most significantly, we have seen evidence that criminals are drawn to virtual currencies for two main reasons. First, their perception that virtual currencies offer greater anonymity than traditional financial services, And second, the irreversibility of many virtual currency transactions.
Rahman told the committee it's not necessary to pass new laws to regulate currencies like Bitcoin, saying the laws already on the books, including a new regulation approved this March, are good enough. But as Delaware Democrat Tom Carper, the only senator to attend Monday's hearing, expressed interest in passing additional regulations on digital currency, some believe the existing regulations are excessive and suppressing innovation. Bitcoin and other virtual currencies currently have to comply not only with federal anti-money laundering and terrorist financing rules, but also with state-by-state licensing requirements. They also have to keep records of their customers and report suspicious transactions. According to the Financial Times, the Bitcoin Foundation is reportedly considering moving its headquarters to a country without such regulations. At this week's hearing, the foundation's Patrick Merck asked Congress to make only safe and sane regulations, saying Bitcoin is, quote, not some magic cloaking device that allows criminals free rein. He also touted the merits of such digital currencies, highlighting their potential to help low-income people in the developing world and in the United States who can't access a traditional bank.
There is a rising tide of unbanked and underbanked people right within our borders. This is important because access to financial services directly correlates to increases in dignity, liberty, and self-determination. Bitcoin can help move people trapped in a cash-based informal economy into a globally connected digital economy.
The value of Bitcoin on internationally traded markets has widely fluctuated since it went live in 2009, but it soared to an all-time high of $900 per Bitcoin following the hearing. The Senate Banking Committee will have a turn to ask its own questions on Tuesday afternoon. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
So if, like me, you still don't quite understand what Bitcoin is, help is at hand. I'm joined on the line now by Jerry Britto of the nonprofit Mercatus Center at George Mason University here in Washington. And Jerry, in basic terms, this is a virtual currency, right? So it doesn't actually exist as a tangible item.
Well, it can exist as a tangible item, but maybe I won't confuse you with that first. Yes, it's a virtual currency, but we've had virtual currencies for a long time, right? We've had Facebook credits or Microsoft points or even airline miles. These are all sort of virtual currencies. What makes Bitcoin unique, it's a decentralized virtual currency. And so what do I mean by that? Other virtual currencies are centralized, meaning that there is a company or an organization or a government of some sort that is issuing the currency. So, for example, Facebook issues Facebook credits, and you buy them from Facebook, and then you can use them to buy goods or services or trade them with others. Bitcoin is not a company. It's not a government. There's no organization behind Bitcoin. It's a peer-to-peer network, just like email is.
And what is determining the value here? I mean, if you look at the United States dollar, the dollar says that the United States Treasury stands by its value, and we all know that things like the gold standard for many years have been used as the basis for the valuations of currencies. What underpins the value of a Bitcoin unit?
There is nothing underpinning it, just like there's nothing underpinning the U.S. dollar, except people's faith that others will take it in payment for goods and services.
So where does all this go? I mean, if you look down the road, with Bitcoin seeming to become more respectable, are we all going to have Bitcoin accounts in the same way as we've got sort of frequent flyer accounts that have a certain translatable value?
I think that's very possible. But I think eventually it might be the case that we will be using Bitcoin without even knowing it. So, for example, I recently helped my mother. She's from Spain, and helped her send money back home. And we used a service that's very popular, and it's one of the least expensive services. But it costs 5% of the amount we sent to Spain to send money from the U.S. to Europe. I mean, this is the 21st century. Why should it cost 5%? So I can imagine someday, for example, a remittance service that allows you to send money overseas. And as far as you're concerned, you're putting in dollars. At the other end, your family member is taking in euros. But in between, it is a Bitcoin network that's being employed.
Have you explained Bitcoin to your mother?
She kind of gets it.
I'm going to have to hire you to explain it to mine. Jerry Britto at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University here in Washington. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Now, from Bitcoin to gin, a global sales surge in gin is paving the way for micro distilleries to move back to London, where they were once in abundance during the 1800s. There are now five of these small-scale craft distillers in the British capital who have seen excellent returns and exports. Some attribute the revival of gin's popularity to big brands putting money in to educate younger drinkers, but there are other contributing factors, as FSN's London correspondent Natalie Powell reports.
Darren Rook is the CEO of the London Distillery Company. They're the first whiskey distillers in London for over 200 years. But it was the company's gin-making venture which started for cash flow reasons, as Darren's Dodds gin takes less time to make than his whiskey, that has given the firm instant profit.
We sort of see the 25 to 35-year-old, rather than going into a bar and saying, I want a gin and tonic, they're going into a bar and saying, what gin do you have? But again, it comes down to Pernod Ricard and Diageo and spending the money 5-10 years ago educating people. So for small brands like ourselves, it's the major saving grace of big brands.
If you look at it globally, craft and super premium gin has seen a year-on-year growth of 22%. And for the gin-making process, there's only a four-week turnaround from distillation to bottle. London gin, meanwhile, is a well-known style of gin. It doesn't necessarily have to be made in London, though. Even so, there's a historical association between gin and London. And now we're seeing a resurgence here, with more craft distillers setting up business in the capital. They've seen a great deal of interest from buyers, not just at home, but abroad too. One of those micro distilleries in particular is Sipsmith, which opened for business in 2009, and as Sipsmith co-founder Sam Galsworthy explains, has seen sales triple each year.
And right now, that's off some reasonably big numbers for us. You know, of our sales, 25% of them now, maybe a third of them actually go overseas, which is really exciting. It's certainly ahead of where we wanted to be. And, you know, with the UK cruising at an extraordinary rate, both in the retail and the HoReCa sector, you know, and tripping every year on that, it's a pretty exciting place to be. But, you know, when you look internationally too, we've not even opened up half the markets that we want to be in, principally because we can't make enough.
And retailers too are noticing how what was once seen as quite an old-fashioned drink is now having a revival. Ronnie Cox is the brand's heritage director at Berry Brothers and Rudd Spirits, one of the oldest spirit and wine merchants in London.
There are lots of different things which have contributed to it. First and foremost, I think, is the fact that London has now become the sort of cocktail capital of the world, and these up-and-coming bartenders or mixologists or people who have really got to grips with this are using gin today as the base for a lot of their cocktails, whereas before they used to use vodka. And I think what's so really interesting about the younger generation is that they're finding out so much more about these products. They're no longer advertised at and accept what is written in the advertisement. They have their own opinions and they will find out from other means, and particularly the internet, but also tastings, you know, what suits their palate. And then it becomes a sort of trend.
So it seems that big and small distilleries alike will continue to experiment with gin while spirits are still high and cash in on it before fashions move on once again. Natalie Powell, London.
And now to coin a phrase for something completely different.
Monty Python's a flying circus.
It was confirmed in London today that the surviving members of Monty Python's Flying Circus are getting back together to mount a new stage show. It will be the first time they've performed together since 1998. For those of us of a certain age, John Cleese, Eric Idle, Michael Palin, Terry Gilliam and Terry Jones redefined comedy along with their now deceased colleague Graham Chapman. Earlier today I spoke to Martin Lewis, a Hollywood-based humorist and commentator who has produced shows with members of the Monty Python team.
Monty Python was a complete breakthrough, first of all in Britain and then the rest of the world in terms of comedy. It took the existing forms of comedy and gave it such a twist, an absurdist twist if you like, and explored areas of humour that had never really happened, certainly not in British in the British world before. What they did was they made fun of the pomposity of British life, and they came up with just wonderful juxtapositional comedy. The notion of the world's greatest philosophers being soccer players. The notion that there should be a summarized Proust contest. The notion that a dead parrot might possibly come back to life if you put 4 million volts of electricity through it. These were just aspects of humor that nobody had explored before, and the impact of Monty Python was considerable.
And they went on to influence a generation of comedians.
A generation and more. Their work started out on television, but then they branched into stage shows, movies, and all the people that followed them in Britain and America were completely influenced by the Pythons. And I know this firsthand from conversations with the creators of South Park, with whom I worked once on a Monty Python tribute. I know this from Eddie Izzard, from pretty much every major comedian in the English-speaking world, and probably quite a few outside the English-speaking world, have been influenced by Monty Python.
Now, in the decades since Monty Python's Flying Circus was first produced, comedy has changed. Audiences, of course, have changed. Will they face any challenges, do you think, in reaching younger audiences with their comedy? Will their comedy still seem fresh?
Not only will it seem fresh, it will actually have this rare quality called funny. listen, there's always new comedians coming along, and some are very good. But I think a general consensus is that television comedy and a lot of movies that are described as hilarious turn out to be not that funny. The Monty Python team were always incredibly inventive. Their comedy was not a formula. They did not have a team of 30 writers putting their shows together. Their comedy came from within themselves. And in their subsequent solo endeavors, be it Michael Palin's TV shows or John Cleese's movies or Eric Idle's Spamalot show, the humor has continued to entrance audiences, not just the old folks, but the young folks as well. It's very akin to the music of the Beatles. The Beatles' music is timeless. It doesn't matter if you're a first-generation fan with the Beatles or you're a youngster. You like the Beatles. And that is the lesson of Monty Python. And I think that's going to be shown again.
And is it your expectation, Martin, that we're going to be seeing the classic old stuff done by the Monty Python troupe, albeit now a little bit grey-haired? Or do you think we're going to be seeing new original work?
I'm fairly sure that there's going to be a mixture. There's no way that they could possibly go on stage and not do some of the old favourites without being lynched. That's a certainty. There's bound to be a desire on behalf of the audience, and I think the Pythons themselves, to revisit some of the classics. But in addition to that, I think it is entirely likely that they will be tempted to come up with some new material. For example, on their 30th anniversary in 1999, they came up with a few new skits. I myself had a hand in putting together something for them, which was I mentioned a South Park tribute to Monty Python, and that was incorporated in the show. They themselves could not resist the temptation to do a couple of skits. So I think there will be a mixture of the golden oldies, so to speak, and possibly a few new golden oldies to come.
Martin Lewis on the enduring appeal of Monty Python's Flying Circus. And so we play ourselves out tonight with the closing song from Life of Brian, the classic Monty Python film produced in 1979. That's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. Let us know what you think of the programme by email at reports@featurestory.com. I'm Simon Marks in Washington, alongside producer Kevin McAleese. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.
Nothing will come from nothing, you know what I say? Oh, cheer up, you old bugger. Give us a grin. There you are. See? The end of the film. Incidentally, this record's available in the foyer. Someone's got to live as well, you know. Who do you think pays for all this rubbish? Always look. I couldn't make the money back, you know. I told him. I said to him, Bernie, I said, they'll never make that money back.